Welcome back to the Underwater Sunshine Podcast. This will be part three of our punk spectacular, or our punk spunktacular. I am one of your hosts, Adam Duritz. I'm here with my pal,
James Campion, and I've been now calling this Underwater Punkcast. We can't stop ourselves. We're only up to 1977, and the rest of the country hasn't even discovered punk yet.
As we mentioned last time, in March of 1977, The Clash went from opening for The Pistols to releasing their first single in March of 77. This is that song, The Clash, off their first album, White Riot.
Joe Strummer, Mick Jones, Paul Simonon, and Topper Heaton, and a great, great song of what we ended the last podcast with, which was with the idea that the entire youth movement in England felt, as the Sex Pistols sing in God Save the Queen, no future, no future. Here come the Clash, who have some answers. Sex Pistols don't have any answers. They want to throw stones at glass houses. And here is the Clash calling to order. Are you taking over, or are you taking orders? Are you going backwards, or are you going forwards? Which I've used many times quoting in columns I've written. It's a call to order. It's a call of action, which is very, very, again, new to this nihilistic, pre-nihilistic punk idea that the Sex Pistols make big based on their cursing on a TV show and pissing on the Queen. But this is a band that has the answers now.
Well, they're not. I mean, a lot of punk is nihilistic, and you know, as Richard Hell puts, I belong to a blank generation.
Right?
I am without hope in some ways. I don't see a future. The Clash aren't like that. It's not just in terms of their politics. They're ambitious. I mean, it's not just in terms of their politics and what they want people to go out there and change things, but they're going to change things too. Musically, they're going to be ambitious. They're going to make double albums.
Yeah.
They're
going to play reggae. They're going to play ska. They're going to play...
But what better description is there of what the malaise that hit rock and roll when people are making these bloated double albums? Well, the Clash are going to make double albums too. They're going to make several of them. In fact, one of them is kind of a triple album if you think of Sandinista.
Yeah.
They're going to make big epic opuses. They're going to reach for all kinds of different musical ideas and bring it together in what they want to do. They're going to play different kinds of national music. They're, like you said, they're going to play reggae. They're going to play dub. They're going to be listening to Lee Scratch Perry. You know, and they're going to go to America and work with Sandy Pearlman, who had produced, is it Blue Oyster Cult? Sandy Pearlman did? Give Him Enough Rope, one of my favorite records growing up.
Right.
They are not nihil. They see the future. They don't know what's going to happen in the future, but they're going to do their best to be a part of it. They're going to tell you what to do. They're going to give you suggestions for how to break down the nationalism and society we have.
Right.
And they're going to go make all kinds of music. They want to be the thing.
They want to be the legitimate band. They want to rise above the punk movement. I remember when I interviewed Paul Stanley years ago for a piece, and then I ended up quoting him in my Kiss book. He said, you know, everybody wanted to get into Max's Kansas City. We wanted to be an arena band. We wanted to get the rest of the country involved. Everybody wanted to be cool in New York, and we wanted to be cool everywhere. The
Who
Clash,
said that?
Paul Stanley, about Kiss, because they came up out of that whole New York thing, but they weren't attached, to even the glam of the New York Dolls or the punk movement, although they were right there, 72, 73, 74. So,
and they're clearly influenced by the glam, because look at their clothes.
Oh, no question. And the first record specifically, it sounds like Slade, but If you connect the dots, which are easy to connect, between White Riot, are you taking over or are you taking orders? Are you going backwards or are you getting forwards? With the line in arguably their most famous song, London Calling, London is drowning and I live by the river, which is a great, I've already learned how to swim. I'm already in the shit. You may be drowning, but I've already felt it, and that's how I always took that song. You could be taking it any way you want.
Well, I think there's also a thing in there. London is drowning and I live by the river. I'm going to be the first one to go under.
I'm the first to go. Right.
I better figure out a way out of here because,
That's the other way, too. So the Clash always seemed to me, which is why, their attitude, the Rolling Stones, the greatest rock and roll band of all times, but it was the Clash, the only band that mattered, was a big deal in 1977, 78, 79, when it just seemed like nobody was... Even bands like the Stones, who were writing Street Fighting Man back in the late 60s, had just become this giant, conglomerate now. And the Clash were the only ones, singing about the stuff that maybe people cared about, like poverty, like racism, like whatever it is that, violence in the streets or economic injustices.
Yeah, they truly mattered because they had ambitions to them, because they would reach for bigger issues, that they would make albums like London Calling, which was what a lot of us... I was so young. What a lot of people loved about the music of the 70s was these big opuses that people would do more with it, that the Pink Floyd would do eventually end up, going for Animals and Dark Side of the Moon and Animals and Wish You Were Here, Into the Wall, that it would become The Wall. That punk was not about that, but the Clash were so good and so
prolific,
righteous too, that they could do London Calling.
Right.
And it didn't undermine them. That they could do Sandinista, which was even bigger, and it wouldn't undermine them. That they could have pop hits, and it didn't matter. It didn't affect them in any negative way. That's in March of 77. 1 month later in April, another band, The Jam. They're hugely influenced, like you mentioned earlier, by The Who. They think of themselves as mods, not punks.
Right.
But that's about how you dress. That's about, they loved the 70s music and the soul music that came before it in the 60s, but so did everybody else. They just didn't want to say it out loud. The truth is, a lot of those people, whether you know it or not, if you're playing a riff, Chuck Berry influenced you. I mean? And there's no way around that. The Jam never called themselves punks, and everybody else was clear to state that they weren't either. They called themselves new mods, kind of.
Right.
But whatever.
And that was a whole movement, the new mod movement. And the clothes and the
They're dressing in
aesthetics.
Suits. There's three of them. But I'm sorry. They're still talking about poverty and the difficulty of growing up in London. Just listen. This is In the City by The Jam.
Kiss.
Yeah, man, the guitars in that song are like, they're like machine guns. It's just like, that's blistering the pace of it.
Drums, too, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, that's as punk as anything else. I mean, only because they say they're not doesn't make it not. But, like, I mean, talk about, he keeps saying about the young, when I tell you about the young idea, no wonder. He's like 18, maybe 19 then. Now, he's not in his 20s. Paul Weller's so young at that moment, playing guitars and singing that, writing those songs. I mean, he's amazing.
And he would go on to have quite a career, a solo career. And it's part of that. Now, what year is this, 77, you said?
Yeah. April of 77.
Yeah, so I'm a freshman in high school then. And we're getting all this stuff. You know, we're getting it. We're teetering between listening to the Boston album and later the Van Halen's first album. And we're all digging on Styx and Fleetwood Mac and Peter Frampton and Kiss, but we're getting an Aerosmith, but we're getting this too. You know, this is squeezing in. And people forget what really is happening on the cusp of this, what's about to happen nationally, and it's been happening uptown in New York here, is disco and hip hop. And that's about to hit like big time in 78 with the film Saturday Night Fever, certainly, and all the songs that come along with that. And then later on with Grandmaster Flash and everything that's going on at Washington Heights. So we're right on the cusp of that. Punk has their little window here, and they're going to have some, they're going to get their face time. And then they're going to have their stars like Talking Heads and Blondie that will go on in the 80s and have hits. And The Clash, who is going to be big. But this is their 76, 77 is when punk kind of lifts their head up, and then some other wave comes in and takes on everybody else's attention.
What I remember in Oakland at that point is definitely Elvis Costello and Joe Jackson,
yep.
But also a lot of the Commodores and P-Funk.
I didn't even talk about that, right? The whole
and Earth, Wind & Fire.
Still Stevie Wonder's rocking stuff out.
Yeah,
and,
but specifically the dances, I remember a lot of like Reasons, Easy, Brick House.
Right, Patti LaBelle stuff.
Yeah, I mean that's sort of like really hitting, but I don't remember the jam then. I don't know that I'd heard it yet at that point then out there. But I mean, that's a pretty killer song. I mean, and he's a kid. He's such a kid right then, you know.
It's right in the wheelhouse, no question.
It's you know, I'm in seventh grade, so I'm like 13, seventh grade at that point, a little younger than you. There's so many great songs that came out this year. When I was looking through all this stuff and and checking them out, some that I didn't that I remembered from listening to this ages ago, but that I didn't. By this I mean this box set. you know, the Jam I got into myself much more later, but some of these bands I don't remember hearing much more outside of this. But there's so much music coming out because punk is exploding, especially in England. You know. We just played the Sex Pistols in the last podcast, The Clash this time, The Jam. This is a band I wanted to check out. It's a London band called The Boys. And they really presage a lot of the things that become great right after this. Because one of the other things that blows up out of this time is this guitar pop thing that becomes really big. Power pop and guitars, you know, like, I guess Cheap Trick in a way.
That's a good one. That's
but
good
also one. The Cars. About a year or two later, I think.
Right. And that's where I put Blondie in that area.
Well, I wanted to play this song because when I was listening to it last week, just the... about a year and a half after this, The Cars come out with this sound, with vocals, with melodies that really sounds like just a more tightly controlled and tightly produced version of this.
Oh, that's interesting.
This is a song by The Boys called First Time. I don't think they ever really blew up. None of their stuff really hit in England, but it's really good. And they were around for a while, but they just never really... None of it really was very successful. None of it really charted. It kept flopping. This was their second single, and it didn't really make any impact on anybody, but it's... Well, just listen to it. This is The Boys with First Time. We'll be right back. do you think of that?
Yeah, you mentioned the Cars and you nailed it right from the very beginning when I was listening to it. It does sound like a sped up version of the Cars. It's like gung 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 gung, you know, that they put in there.
It's also like da ba ba ba. The first time,
it sounds just like, what I needed.
Think, is that what
just
song
what
it is?
I needed. Yeah,
it's some it car like. Song. It's the exact same melody a few years later. I don't know. It just reminded me of it.
Right. Well, you know, it's within the purview because the Cars were on the cusp of. They were considered new wave or the new kind of rock and roll. They kind of escaped. The Cars were just kind of like so popular. They kind of escaped any kind of, hey, it's that. They were just the Cars. There was a pop rock album that came out and everyone bought it and it was huge and it was on the radio. And
well, it sounded like nothing else, though, because of the production, the way they did it. And because of the song craftsmanship was so good. But they were really into how it was produced and the very, like, I don't know. It's
dead and forceful. But Rick Ocasek is singing in the very punk style that we've been talking about for weeks now. But all right, so 77, we're rolling along now.
And we talked about that band Rocket from the Tombs in Cleveland, that half of them become Pere Ubu. The other half, Cheetah Chrome and Johnny Blitz invite Steve Baters, Jimmy Zero, and Jeff Magnum, and they form this band called Frankenstein. They call it Frankenstein for a minute. Then the Ramones come on tour to Cleveland, and they meet the Ramones, and they talk Joey in to get them an audition at CBGB's. So they go and audition, they get the gig, they ask Hilly Crystal to be their manager, they move to New York, and they change their name to the Dead Boys. They almost immediately, they become the wildest band. They're so good live, and they're so out there that everyone's blown away immediately by the Dead Boys, and they get signed to Sire, and they record Young, Loud, and Snotty. And we talked about something about a sonic reduction in that Pere Ubu song.
Yes.
Well, here you go, man. Check this out. This is off of Young, Loud, and Snotty, Sonic Reducer.
Yeah!
you know, I said earlier, and I think the first podcast we did on the punk stuff, that the Modern Lovers Roadrunner was the quintessential. That to me, this is A1. I would play this song if someone said, "Hey, punk, See, this is what I was trying to think of when you first contacted me and said, "You know, I'm thinking let's do a punk show." And we wanted to do one, and we both love punk, and as we respect and love all kinds of music, but specifically this. And I what I did was instead of doing the kind of Herculean research you've done, I just immediately said, "What says punk to me? What takes me back to being a kid and listening to this and being like, yeah!" And that's what that does.
Dead Boys aren't a band that a lot of people really know necessarily. They didn't have the other kinds of hits, you know, kind of mainstream hits. But if you're like a real music, if you're a music fan, or let's call us what we are, if you're a music geek, then like punk music, the Dead Boys are punk music. You know, like that's a, like you said, that might be the quintessential song. You know, right. And when I was thinking of like, when I was writing about like New York punk life, when I was trying to sort of conjure that up in my head in some ways for Palisades Park, for where those kids were headed when they went to New York City in Palisades Park, you know. I mean, I was thinking of the Velvets in some ways, but it's, you know, but it's later than that, you know, and it's really like, it's the Dead Boys on Bowery, you know. Even though they're not from New York, they instantly become a part of New York when they get here. They leave Cleveland behind, and they, you know, they're just so vicious and fun. You know, it just, they combine everything. It's just, it's,
well, they
great
embody
stuff.
It. So when they came here, it's like, these are our people. And I would say that along with, and I mentioned Aerosmith in the last segment, I bought Toys in the Attic because the cover's so cool. That's really why. That's how I got introduced to Aerosmith. I'm not going to lie. I bought it. I was like, oh, I got to listen to this. The Dead Boys album, the one that you have on your shirt, you know, I don't even know if it's, is it this one? Is this the first one? Yeah, yeah. I got this one. That I bought that record mainly because the cover is so cool. They just look cool and pissed, and I want to be in that band. I want to listen to this. I want to blast it and upset my parents and anyone around me. That, you know, that's, I mean, and that's what that music speaks to. But anything that's called the Dead Boys is going to get my attention. And
I love their names. I love that they all had those names.
Well, Stiv Bators is a fantastic name.
Johnny Blitz, Jimmy Zero, Jeff Magnum, Stiv Bators, and Cheetah Chrome.
Cheetah Chrome.
I mean, that's just, they're just, there's one of the songs on the album where they're just, they're talking to each other and Cheetah's like, "Hey, Stiv, yeah, Cheetah." I can't remember which song it is. They're just talking about this girl, and they're like, "Hey, Stiv, yeah, Cheetah. What do you want? I don't know, man. I want to rebel." It's just incredible.
Yeah, yeah.
They have these great voices, and they're just so fucking cool.
Right, right.
You know, I was, when I was growing up in the Bay Area playing in bands, I used to go see this this woman play, Penelope Houston, and she was this like kind of acoustic folk band she had with Jimmy Wesley, I can't remember his name. He was a guitar player. And I was really into her, and I had a crush on her. You know, she was pretty and cool, and I wasn't cool at all yet. You know, yet. I was going to get cool.
You're working on
it. Damn it. I just wasn't cool enough yet. But I really liked the band, and some friend of mine, I cannot remember who it was. I was trying to remember. Somebody said, "Well, you should have, if you like this, man, you should have seen The Avengers, because that was it." And I was like, "What do you mean?" Because she was like really cool in the, to me, in the Bay Area scene, you know. And they're like, "Well, she used to be in the punk band, the San Francisco punk band. They were so fucking cool, you know." Because there was the Gilman Street scene over in Berkeley, but there was the Mabuhay Garden scene out in San Francisco that was like, and the Avengers were like, they were the Mabuhay band.
Now she was a singer.
Yeah, she was a singer for the Avengers. You know, and she was, and he had like a cassette, and that's where I remember hearing this song, because like we're talking about this happening all over the place, and certainly there's like the Dead Kennedys are the 924 Gilman, which is also later where Green Day comes out of.
Yeah, sure.
But there are all these posters up that you could see, or in like in the shops where you'd buy the T-shirts and stuff. There would be posters, and they're Mabuhay Gardens, the Avengers at the Mabuhay Gardens. And I always thought the name was cool because I was a comic fan. Yet more evidence of why I wasn't cool yet, you know. But like the Avengers to me was just awesome, and the fact that the Avengers were this band with this really, really cool girl who just seemed so cool to me, even, you know, already even then. And my friend's like, "Well, you got to check out this," you know. And I had heard of them, but I had never heard them because like everything else, it was out of print, you know. But he had a cassette with this song on it and a couple other things. But this is the one I remember. And the Avengers also, you know, as we mentioned in one of the other podcasts, they're the opening band for the Sex Pistols at Winterland, which is the last Sex Pistols
show.
Right,
you said that, yeah.
And they talk about how, like, it was such a big deal for them because they worshiped the Sex Pistols, but when they got there, it was a mess. And then the Sex Pistols broke up, like, a day later, and they just thought, and I think probably with them, too, like, they never really had any success, you know, and rock and roll can be pretty depressing that way. For all the, we get excited about how good it is to play music. Once you start dealing with trying to survive and make money off it, it can be really brutal and depressing.
Yeah, and also that kind of thing matters because, you know, like I said, my band played CBGBs in 86, and that was a big deal to play on that stage, but it was a shithole. It was 1 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday or midnight or whatever. We were worried about a bunch of other bands being wheeled up there like it was the Gong Show. But, I mean, it still, for me, it meant something. And as much as it meant for them, even though it was a disaster and the Sex Pistols were done and they're screaming at the audience, and the Winterland's probably not their best room for the Sex Pistols, especially at that time. But it must have been everything to the Avengers, and they can carry that to their graves. They were on the same bill as the Sex Pistols. That's pretty damn cool.
And, you know, and they weren't nihilistic either. They were probably closer to the Clash than the Sex Pistols. Well, you hear it. This is the Avengers. We are the one.
You're going to DJ my next party, Duritz, because this is a great segue. I don't know where to begin with this. First of all, it's perfect to play after the Dead Boys. I'm completely in love with her, and I don't even know what she looks like. Here's a couple of things. Number one, how many songs? Okay, so they've already got the aesthetic down. They've already got the whole genre wrapped up and bowed. Listen to this fantastic. First of all, it's called We Are the One. And, of course, I'm reminded of I Am Legion, where you have We Are, and then a singular, plural, followed by a singular. And it reminds me of Townsend's I'm the One from Quadrophenia, where he talks about all the personalities that he has, a personality crisis that he has. But he's one. He's this one person. But the chorus is, we are not Jesus, and then they scream, Christ! And then someone else goes, fuck you! It's in the lyric. We are not Jesus Christ! Fuck you! We are not fascist pigs! Fuck you! We are not capitalist industrialists! They scream industrialists. And then we are not communists, we are the one. I'm also reminded, which is excellent on every level as a writer, But I'm reminded of Little Steven and the Disciples of Soul. On his second record, he has a song called I Am a Patriot, which is kind of a reggae song that many people have covered, Jackson Brown, a few other people. But it, in the song, he says, you know, in the bridge, he's like, I am no capitalist. I'm no socialist. I'm no anarchist. I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat. I'm not, you know, and he goes, I stand for freedom. And what they're saying is, you can't put labels on us. And for 20 years, I've written this column called Reality Check for the Aquarian Weekly, in addition to my music writing and pop culture writing. And in that column, I have been writing, which I wanted to call Fear No Art originally, that I am – don't try to pin me with, oh, the argument is, you're just a liberal, blah, blah, you're just a conservative fascist. Every, you know, no matter what argument you make, and they're saying, we got something to say, so don't tell us you know where we're coming from. It's a completely new place, and they even sing about it here. You know, I am the one who brings you the future. I am the one who buries the past. So everything, and I say this all the time about any political theory, any social theory, any cultural theory that people have, people have already tried it and either failed or it continues. It depends on where we're standing. So these people are saying, no. No, they're literally saying, fuck you to all of that. Great song. Maybe I dare say my favorite song we played in 3 weeks. I just love this goddamn song. I love this band. I want to hear the whole record. Is it record on Spotify? Can I get that?
I don't know about Spotify. I think I have it.
Oh, I must hear that. Love them. Love the Avengers.
I will say what it reminded me of listening to. I've always loved this band because I love that chorus. We are not Jesus Christ. We are not fascist pigs. We are not capitalist industrialists. We are not communists. We are the one. I mean,
they're screaming industrialists. But
what it made me think of was I had this like total horrific flashback to growing up in the Bay Area. The Bay Area, man, people love sloganeering.
Oh, they have the anarchist bookstore there. What are you
they love sloganeering. And what I'm remembering is in my first band, playing and drawing some pretty good crowds, and you have to start off pay to play. You got to sell tickets to your own concerts, you know, to get the gigs at the clubs. But after a while, we were really drawing crowds at a bunch of places in the East Bay. We really wanted to get some gigs over in San Francisco and a couple other East Bay clubs. And this one club, the Ashkenaz, which is actually an East Bay club, they had a lot of world beat bands there. And I went in there and took him a tape of our music, and the guy called me up or a little while later, and he's like, yeah, I listened to it. You guys are pretty good, but it's just, it's not right for us. Get back to me when you have something a little more relevant.
Yeah, I remember you
telling me. He wrote me a letter or something and said, no, that's what it is. He wrote it on the thing and sent it back and said, get back to me when you're more relevant. And I was just like, that is so obnoxious. Like the slow,
Yeah, who decides
now? I just think
that?
It's a great story. But like,
it is a great story. He decides, know, who's relevant or not.
You know, it's just like, that's what I mean. Like, you get a movement comes when someone has an idea and they do something, and then everybody, it catches on when everybody else loves the idea too and they want to do it too. But then you get people. It was somebody rebelling against something because they didn't want to be a part of that club and they wanted to be their own thing. And then everybody loves the new thing, and so they join up, and then they start telling people that they're not relevant because they're not in this club, and suddenly you're in a fucking club again, which is not what you wanted to be in. You wanted to be, like, the only one, you know?
Sure.
You're rebelling against something, then you become something, and then you give birth to this whole group of people who go around telling everyone what they're supposed to be, which is... Ugh.
Well, Sting always said you can only rebel so much before you start... It's a circle, you know? Or you mentioned before, Soroboros or whatever, the snake that eats itself. I'm also reminded of the Beatles. Do you remember the Ruddles
film? Sure,
okay, so there's that great scene where Dan Aykroyd's playing basically a composite of every record executive in America who all said, quote unquote, guitar music's not going to make it here. So they all passed on the Beatles in America. Now, they were already pretty popular, but only Capitol absorbed the EMI stuff.
Right.
But up until then, famously like 10 or 12. And so the guy's interviewing him, you know, Eric Idle is, so you said that the Ruddles would never, that this music is a fact, that it would last 10 minutes. And like, you know, Dan Aykroyd's like, yeah, that was me. And he's like, so what is it to be an asshole? A complete asshole. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm reminded that no matter what it is, whether it's your band about being relevant or this band saying we're not going to, nobody wants to be pigeonholed. Nobody, because nobody knows what the hell the next thing's going to be. If they did, they would package it and they'd sell it. They have tried that. In the 80s, they tried it a lot. In the early 90s, mid-90s, they tried it a lot. They would give you, my friend used to say, all they do is just jam Mariah Carey down my throat. I got to like Mariah Carey now. Now, you could pretty much underline anybody. It doesn't have to be Mariah Carey. But he used her as an example of, I got to like this now because that's what they're giving you.
Well, what they figured out a little while after that was that all you had to really do was make a television show. And then you could jam exactly what you wanted down everybody's throat because it was, if you put it on television, everybody would buy it.
Right.
No matter what it was.
Well, American Bandstand or MTV.
Well, I'm thinking of MTV and not just that. I'm thinking of like from American Idol to The Voice to Ashley Simpson and Jessica Simpson's own shows to the Kardashians. If you put it on a TV show, people are going to buy it. You can sell it if you can put it on TV.
Right.
It's as simple as that. If you put it in our faces, we will buy it. Someone will buy it.
But not the Avengers, because they're not going to be capitalists. So
no, they're
fuck
not. They're
you.
Not. But they're not communists either, and they're not fascists, and they're not Jesus.
Apparently,
they're just fucking awesome.
They are.
I mean, it's funny because the next band I want to talk about, this kind of totally accidentally to me actually slides right into it, because one of the big issues with them was always that were they a part of it or not, or were they just dressing the part of it? William Broad, as we talked about, was a member of the Bromley contingent that hung out with. The Sex Pistols and Susie Sue and that whole group of people that they called the Bromley Contingent. He had his own band that he started called Generation X. And I think Generation X is actually kind of great. They have some great songs.
I know some of them.
Now, but he took a
Billy
lot
Idol's
of shit
band.
Then for just being a poser. And eventually he left Generation X and just went solo and sort of proved everyone's point in some ways because he is like the icon of... I mean, yeah, man, he looks fucking amazing.
Yeah.
He's the icon of being a punk. He looks a better punk than anyone else that ever lived, and that's the lead singer for Generation X, the former William Broad, whose name is really Billy Idol.
Right, he's got a little Richard Hell in there. He's got a little Sid Vicious in there. He's got a little Marlon Brando in there from The Wild One. He's got, this, you know, he's got everything. The guy, he basically was, you couldn't have made this person in central casting any better for being a punk. And for some, in the 80s, he's able to co-op that.
Well, because when MTV comes along and you can actually see him the whole time and he's such a good performer.
Yes.
You know, that he just like, he owns MTV. And this is a little bit before that, you know, still in 77.
Yes. And I will say this for the record, and one day I'm sure we'll play it, but White Wedding is one of my favorite songs of the 1980s. It's a fucking great song. I love that song.
Well, you know, he's in this band for a few years and they have some really great songs. One of the ones that he ends, one of the last Generation X songs actually ends up being one of the first Billy Idol songs, which is Dancing With Myself.
Right.
But I want to go back a little before. This is their second single ever. And it's, If the Who Gave Us My Generation, this is Generation X with Your Generation.
your generation. For the end was just a follow me.
I just love that song.
Yeah, I could see where people would be in a little bit of a backlash because they seem to be co-opting a lot of things that are going on at the time. But there's a legitimacy to that stuff. I immediately hear Paranoid by Black Sabbath. That's the only thing it's missing. But there's a real rock foundation there that I think that Billy Idol does not lose when he becomes a big star in the 80s. That's there. So that's a good – that's a nice little bridge from punk, British punk, and – 80s, early 80s rock.
Yeah, I think it's really cool.
It is.
And I mean, I guess I always kind of like Billy Idol.
Yeah.
When I was, where were we? Oh, yeah. It was during when we were making the first record, and T-Bone takes us to Dodger Stadium. No, it was the LA Coliseum to see U2. Because he's friends with them. Bill Flanagan's writing a book on U2 right then. He's come to stay with us, come to visit us in the house when we're recording August. And T-Bone takes us all to go see U2.
Was that the Zoo TV,
Zoo TV tour?
That is one of the greatest shows I've ever seen in my life.
That but what I awesome. Really remember, the other thing I remember is that at some point early, before the show really started, or like one of the after one, during one of the early bands, I looked up behind me where we were sitting, and I could see the there's a concourse, like steps that go up. In the LA Coliseum, where the top, where the Olympic flame was, the steps that come down through the, I mean, you've seen it. It's like in the Olympics. There's that big right. area where the flames at the top.
Where the Raiders played for.
And
a
the
while,
guy
right?
runs up. The, you know, like whether it's Rafer Johnson runs up the steps to light the flame, the torch for the Olympics there, and like Billy Idol's coming in the concert, and he comes in somehow and comes down those stairs, but he's right at the top of the stairs in front of the Olympic flame. You can see him up there. He's just standing there, and he looks, of course, like nobody else but Billy Idol, and he's at the top of it. I can just see him. He's not, like, I don't know who else is looking at him, but he's standing there also, and he's just, like, fists up above the head in the V for Victory, like, me, I'm at the top in front of the Olympic flame in the LA Coliseum. There's, like, 100,000 people here to see you, too. But you know what? They're probably all here to see me. He's got his hands over his head.
So he wasn't even opening? He just happened to be there?
He'd probably come to the concert.
Oh, that's hilarious.
But he just, like, walked up that way and went, at least I think it was him. It just looked like him from up there. It was the most awesome thing. I just remember such a rock and roll moment. Completely fucking awesome. Did you hear of Tom Robinson?
I need more information.
He's got a band called Tom Robinson Band then in the...
No.
At this point. And he's really interesting. He's very, very openly political, left-wing, passes out flyers at all of his concerts.
Kind of like Billy Braggish.
Yeah, yeah. About the issues and what he wants people to do.
Oh, Little Steven.
Very, very participatory in the Rock Against Racism shows that are all going on. Very openly leftist. Also very openly gay, which is pretty rare in 77. One of the songs on his record is called "Glad to Be Gay" or "I'm So Glad to Be Gay." but he has this one fucking awesome song. And strangely enough, it's like a trucker song. It's a song about a trucker. And he said he wrote it because you're in a rock band. One of the experiences you share is the all-night drive with guys who are long-distance truckers. You know, and going coming from a gig somewhere in England, I don't know, like Liverpool or Manchester, heading back into London. And, you know, you're in the van as the sun's coming up. You know, it's that kind of thing that most people don't experience as much as you do. When you're in a band, you're constantly experiencing this, the highway in the middle of the night, like what Jonathan Richman's talking about is a constant part of life in a band, and he was thinking about that, I guess, and he wrote this song about a trucker. It's just a fucking great song. It's got some lyrics I really love. I'm just gonna play it for you. It's funny that like an openly gay leftist man writes one of the classic songs about trucker all night driving songs ever written, and it's just I think he was sort of using it as a metaphor for his life and what he was doing. And, like, I don't know. Anyways, it's called 2468 Motorway. And it's just a killer song. Still in the wonder, the absolute wonder of 1977. It's just that it must have been a killer time.
Yeah, well, everybody was inspired by, like you said before, you know, pick up a guitar and start a band. Then they heard that from Ramones album, or they heard the Velvet Underground album, or they heard the Stooges, and they wanted to start a band. Everybody was getting on board that at that time couldn't find a voice. You know, that was a, you know, to have a movement like that where, and of course, if you're a record guy, go out and find me a punk band.
Yeah, yeah.
Go out and find me the next punk band. And there were plenty of them out there, so they got their voice in 1977.
Well, I mean, Tom Robinson has one too, and you know what? He's really, really fucking good. This is 2468 Motorway. Like that song. I was listening to that like a week ago on here. I kept listening to it over and over again. It's knocking me out.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit of Aaron Dury and the Blockheads and that other version of what we're not even going to go to as far as it wouldn't really consider punk, but just this English kind of style of songwriting that's gets under your skin somehow. When you first hear it, it doesn't really appeal to you, and then after a while you listen to it and you're like, hey, I really like this stuff. You know, it took me a while to get to Ian Dury and the Blockheads, but I really love that stuff now, that early Stiff stuff, besides Elvis Costello's work.
Yeah. I mean, he's really playing in the punk scene, Tom Robinson. You know, it's like, I don't know. I just really love that song. It's funny that when I read about it, the chant, 2, 4, 6, 8, never too late, that whole It comes from a gay liberation protest chant. 2, 4, 6, 8, gay is twice as good as straight. 3, 5, 7, 9, lesbians are mighty fine. That was what that was. And he's singing 2, 4, 6, 8, never too late. Me and my radio trucking on through the night. 3, 5, 7, 9 on a little white line. Motorway sun coming up with the morning light. He's got some great lyrics in there too. Little young lady stardust hitching a ride. But the last verse I really like. There ain't no route you can choose to lose the two of us. Ain't nobody know when you're acting right or wrong. No one knows if a roadway's leading nowhere. I just got to keep driving home on the road I'm on.
It's good. Yeah, and you know, the gay sensibilities, I'm trying to think. To me, especially Transformer, what Lou Reed did on that record, giving you a glimpse into the other side. But there's not many gay voices, especially in rock, macho rock music, or even punk rock music. So that in itself is a very punk thing to do.
Yeah, and I mean, and although he's got songs like Glad to Be Gay where he's very open about it, he's not calling any attention to it here. It's not part of the style. It's almost like a pub rock punk thing there.
Right.
He's actually chosen to do the all-night van ride and sort of take the metaphor of a trucker instead.
Right. Sure.
Talking about his rig, you know. It's interesting that he'd make that choice with it. We're kind of at the end of 1977 now, but I wanted to finish with one more song by this band. I don't really know much about them. I just know that they're called The Motors. A bunch of the guys, there was a pub rock band called Ducks Deluxe, or Duck Deluxe, which was like a really hard one of the, you know, other than Brinsley Schwartz, one of the more famous of the pub rock bands. A couple of guys in this band were from that band, and they also, Nick Garvey and Andy McMaster. And they actually got together with their vocalist for The Motors, later had a solo career, Bram Tchaikovsky. I just thought this song was so great. And I read one thing where somebody, maybe it was in this box set, where the guy said, you know, if they just, you know, maybe been looked a little different or been American, or if the career turned out differently, they'd have been in a British version of Cheap Trick, who actually covered this song.
The first Cheap Trick album, I think, is more punk than anything else. It really is. I didn't even really mention that earlier when you brought up Cheap Trick. But if you listen to the first Cheap Trick record, before they kind of became Cheap Trick, I'm having a hard time getting that out, that they were very influenced by, absolutely, they were a punk band, period. It's a punk record. And it's something that, thanks to you, I was able to talk to Robin Zander about at the when I went with you for the thing over at the Irving Plaza.
The press thing we did.
The Live Nation thing, and we got to meet Rick Nelson and Nielsen and Robin Zander. We talked about that first record, and I said, you know, that's a punk record, and he goes, oh, it absolutely is, you know. And they ended up becoming a rock pop band, sort of like a power pop, as you mentioned. But
well, like the Boys, that they are the power pop band that,
yeah,
you know, that the Boys never became in some ways.
Yeah,
but this song too. Yeah. This song, they had a couple U.S. hits after this. But this song was never a hit, I guess. Although this song on the Cheap Trick album, Next Position Please, they cover this song, Dancing the Night Away. So this is The Motors.
Believe that the things that you read and you think.
I love how that song shifts into like 6/8 or something in the chorus. Dancing the night away, gun gun. Dancing the night away, dun dun.
Yeah,
it's like it's such a weird change. And it's so great.
Yeah, I love the.
Yeah,
it kind of reminds me of what the Edge does on those early U2 songs.
Yeah, it's a great little guitar line in there. They're a cool band. That's a great song.
Yeah. It is.
There was a book that I read. Did you ever read? I think we talked this once. Gina Arnold's book, Route 666,
Road to Nirvana. No, but you mentioned, I really should.
Yeah, it was written by this woman, Gina Arnold, who was a columnist in the Bay Area for like the SF Weekly or the Bay Guardian, one of the free papers. And she wrote a lot of music pieces. She has a lot of attitude. Like I talk about, you know, I never liked the people who tell everybody what they should and shouldn't be. And she had a lot of that. But that said, she wrote a fucking amazing book called Route 666, The Road to Nirvana. And it's kind of the story of, I mean, a lot of the indie music charting a path around the country and the growth of indie rock in America in the early 90s. Well, 80s mostly. Bands like Black Flag especially. Because by the time we came along and started touring, I mean, there was essentially a map around America. There was a club in every city, whether it's like the 930 Club in D.C. or Pearl Street up in Northampton, Mass., or the Metronome in Burlington, Vermont, the Avalon in Boston. I think it's called the Avalon. You know, a number of clubs in New York. And you could go from the Roxy or the Whiskey in L.A. You could go from San Francisco to L.A. Portland had La Luna. I can't remember the one in Seattle. They're in every city, though. And you could go from one to another and make it all the way around the country. Liberty Hall in Lawrence, Kansas. And, you know, these are all these places that were just sort of independent venues in some town. Not the big venue, but like just small clubs. And it was, you know, one of the things about Black Flag when they first came along, you know, they started in like 77. They start their own record label, SST.
Right. We used to get all that stuff in Record World, all the imports. For this
Black Flag imports. In 78, and they put out their own first record on that, Nervous Breakdown. This is long before they had a lot of lead singers. This is long before Henry Rollins is in the band. This is Keith Morris is a singer. Greg Ginn. What's the other guy's name? Chuck Dukowski. But they really They were an incessant touring band. They just worked and worked and worked at it. And they kind of charted a path around the country by finding a club in every place to play. They figured out a route for the bands to take around the country. That's followed by, you know, R.E.M., the B-52s, Camper Van Beethoven, the Meat Puppets, you know, all the bands that, you know, Pavement, that then go following them around the country, and including us, and the Gigolo Ants and all of our friends like Chainsaw Kittens, that we followed this route around the country. You know, you could go from place to place to place, but you can make it as a touring band in America because there was some place in every town. You didn't have to just drive from New York to Chicago to Detroit to San Francisco to LA and back. You know, there's a place to go everywhere. It's an amazing book. But, you know, it's really at the core of the book is the work Black Flag did as a touring band that laid the groundwork for all the rest of us too. And they seem important to me, not just because of that, but because they established their own independent label. And one of the things that leads from punk music to the indie rock explosion in the 80s is all of the independent labels that come along, like Rough Trade and SST, of course, that right away my brain would just what's the one that REM is on? Are they on
IRS?
They're on IRS. Yeah, yeah. There's just a lot of them, and but I think it starts with SST really, as far as the modern indie labels. And anyway, this is from the first Black Flag thing. This is Wasted. I think this song is later cut. I heard this song for the first time. Camper Van Beethoven had it on one of their early records, really early records. But it's really a Black Flag song.
And where are they from, Black Flag?
Shit, I can't remember. L.A. Oh, I think they're from L.A.
Right. And it's funny because we got all the Black Flag stuff in the 80s from England or from Europe. We'd get the imports of it. There was like no American versions of those records. Well,
that's really where the American hardcore comes from, is like L.A. and Orange County and all the like Pasadena in that area, I think. I think that's where they're from. They're from like Southern California. Anyways, dig this. This is Wasted by Black Flag. Ah.
jacked up, I was so drunk up, I was so napped out, I was out of my head. I was so wasted. I was wasted.
That's what they call in the parlance a ditty.
Yeah, not a long song. It's 52 seconds of fucking pure rock and roll.
It is.
I was a hippie. I was a fuck up. I was so wasted. I was wasted. The end. Fuck
That's
you.
That's it. They didn't have anything else, man. They were wasted and they're fuck up. So they can't write anything more than 56 seconds. So go screw yourself there. 7.5 minute songs.
But they wrote a million of them and a career that's still going on. So it's like, yeah they're fucking, they turned out they could do that shit forever, which is pretty impressive. And like I said, you know, whatever you may think of them in some ways, they start the first indie record label really right there, you know, in modern times. Obviously, Chess and those things were labels in their own way. And that makes it also possible for a shitload of other bands to make records too, because they did that. Not only charting a course around the country for all the rest of us, but starting a label that people could be on when the majors don't want you, which means you can start a culture on a label and you can build an audience through the culture. And, you know, there's a lot that goes into that sure. turns out to be, just like CBGB's was, can be immensely important for people.
Right, and Sub Pop later on, and a lot of the underground newspapers, like we said, the punk newspapers in New York would inspire people to try to start indie labels or try to find ways to get the music out, even if they're running around with cassettes like Daniel Johnston in Austin, Texas, or Ani DeFranco here in New York, where she used to make her own cassettes, and just, you know, and now she owns Righteous Babe Records, and it's one of the best, you know, longest running indie labels in the country.
Yeah, and she made a lot of money by having her own label all those years.
Yep, and they tried to get her on labels, you know, by the second and third album. She never would do it.
Yeah, it sounds like a great idea. I'd love to get 18% or 15% of my money when I could just take 100%. Now that I've built an audience, the first thing I should do is come on your major label. So instead of taking 100%, I can get 10. Yeah, that sounds really great. Thank you. Fuck you. You know,
thank you, Black Flag, for showing the way.
I was thinking about Gene Arnold because when we, you know, one of the first things we did on our first tour was going through Memphis. Dan and I went to Ardent and met. Who do we meet when we walk in the door to Ardent? We just want to go to Ardent because it's where Big Star recorded. It was the Big Star like label, you know, and we're just like in awe of it. You know, it's like going to Graceland for other people. We went to Ardent. And who's standing there inside the door, because he's running Ardent at that point, but Jody Stevens, the drummer for Big Star. And we just freaked. We were just, it was so awesome. And we talked to Jody for a while, and he was incredibly nice, charming, and just the coolest guy ever. And I suppose that one time I was able to form words, you know.
With the drummer.
So as a result, a few months later, when Big Star had done that Columbia concert already, where they reunited with the guys from the Posies, and they put on that concert in Missouri, at the University of Missouri, they decided to do a few more concerts. And they were doing one in San Francisco at the now-reopened Fillmore. And they called us to ask if we would play it with them. And I mean, that's the biggest honor of my life, you know, because that's my favorite band. That's it for me. And they're reforming, and they want us to open, along with the Gigolo Ants, which is where I met Dave Gibbs, and we became like best friends for the rest of our lives, leaning on the stage watching Big Star play later that night. That's when we were blowing up, about as big as we could be, possibly. And I agreed to do it, but I said on one condition, and that was that we be allowed to not use our name. Because I was really afraid if we put up a concert for Big Star, one of the only three in existence, that a bunch of Counting Crows fans would pile in and fill it up. And that just seemed all wrong. So I said, well, I would do it as long as we could just keep it a total secret and we would be the Shatners for that concert. Because I wanted it to be a Big Star crowd. I wanted them to have like this great show, you know. And of course, they sold it out anyways. It worked perfectly well. We were the Shatners and no one knew we were playing. So the Gigolo Ants went on and then we went on and, you know, people freaked out, and then Big Star went on, and they were like one of the transcendent experiences of my life. And it turned out exactly how I wanted it to turn out, which is that like we got to play a concert with the heroes, my all-time heroes in my life, really. And we didn't fuck up their concert by having it all be Counting Crows fans. And I got to see Big Star from the side of the stage because I was, you know, I'm with the band, you know. And it was the greatest experience of my life in some ways. But then like a day later, the reviews came out, and Gina Arnold, writing in whatever paper it is, just tears us a new asshole because her point is that we're not as good as Big Star. So we shouldn't be there. And everyone makes a big deal of Counting Crows and fuck Counting Crows. This was Big Star. And I'm like, I'm on your team. I wanted to say, I'm on your side. What are we fighting over this? You know, I love them just as much as you do. I went to England to get these records. I worship these guys. And they asked me because they like me.
Right.
And I like them. And we get along great. You know, later that summer, we would have Alex open for us.
Alex Chilton, sure.
And I stayed friends with Alex for years. And I understand how this happens. You know, you just like, you want everyone to understand that, like, no, Counting Crows isn't the big deal. Big Star's the big deal.
Right.
You know, I get
right.
that. But, like, sometimes it's just like.
Well, I remember when you first told me that story, you were like, the basic theme of that article is, how dare they attach themselves to the great Big Star? Are we supposed to believe that Counting Crows is even in the ballpark? And meanwhile, you're trying not even to be on the bill.
Well, I'm just trying to be a secret. But the other thing is, like, Gina, me, and you were on the same team.
Right, yeah.
I love Big Star. They are the heroes of my entire life. They are the greatest band that ever lived, as far as I'm concerned. I worship them, and they asked me anyways. They like us. You know, it's just like, the thing about it was that I had thought it through, and I had a plan, and it was perfect. Everything went perfect until the review came out.
Well, it's only one person's review.
No, I know, but it was like, oh, it just felt so unnecessary. It was my local paper, and it was like, oh, god damn it.
Right.
You know, it's not like it was a national show. It was a San Francisco show.
Sure.
In a place that holds, I don't know, a couple thousand people, maybe. It's not a big place. There weren't a lot of reviews. I just, like, I felt like this is my favorite band in the whole world. They've reunited, and they want me there.
Yeah.
Like, because I'm on their team. This is the validation I've been waiting my whole life for, because this is the band I've waited my whole life to see. Literally my all-time favorite band.
And this was 25 years ago, and it's still bugging
you. Oh, it's still fresh.
This is like the third time you've told me this story, and every time, it's like the first time. You're
just
as aggravated. Or not really aggravated. You're more despondent and everything. One thing you've never told me about this story? Did you ever have a conversation with Gina after that? Have you ever had the conversation that you're having with me right now?
No, I've never even met her. The funny thing
so she should know that.
Well, the funny thing is, I actually liked her too. I thought she was snotty about some things sometimes.
Right.
But like, I'm one of the guys who went out. I had gone out and bought her book,
and you tout it.
I read her column every week. Look, I'm not bitter about this. Still, I'm still telling you all, you should fucking read this book because it's genius,
right.
and she's a great writer in some ways.
But she was wrong about this.
Well, it's something Emmy used to always tell me. I liked her more than him. He thought she was too snotty, and I thought, yeah, but I like a lot of the same music she likes.
Right.
So I kind of liked her, you know, because she worshipped Big Star. I worship Big Star. You know, there were things, I can't remember the rest of it. There were other bands. She had really good taste, in my opinion. She just, you know, this is one of my big problems with I love music criticism for people who love music because it gets me great records to buy. I get tired of music criticism where it's about what they hate because it's just so dumb. And you're always, what you don't realize is that you're making a point that you don't. I don't. Whatever. It's this is. I'm going on too long.
Well, I will say this as a writer, and I'm not really a music critic. I've been called that. I'm not, though. And the funny thing is, I've had battles with people, famous and not so famous, about stuff. And my assistant Danielle always tells me, you're the one guy who told me when I first hired her. She's a young writer, and I got her hooked up at the Aquarian. And you said the first thing you ever told me was, if you don't like something, then don't write about it. You're not there to trash bands. Some people are, but my old feeling was, if I go to see something and I don't like it, I just won't write about it. That's it. They won't get my words. That's it. I am not there to go, you know what? I'm not trying to stand on the wall and protect you all from fill in the blank. If I don't like it, I don't like it. There's some things I don't like. That's fine. I see the worth of it, but I don't want to spend 1,200 words on it. If I'm really pumped up, like I was with Monks of Doom when Immer gave me that record, I wasn't sure I was going to like it. I love Immer, you know, but I love it, and I was glad to spend 1,500 words. And that's why I met you, and I write about the Counting Crows, because I won't do it. I won't write about it. I agree, it doesn't serve anyone by ripping on something, especially young and up-and-coming bands, because, you know, what are you trying to do, save everybody from fill-in-the-blank? I don't get that. Never did. That's a good conversation from another podcast, though.
I want to say, once again, I want to really thank these box set, No Thanks, the Punk Rock Rebellion, and the people at Rhino put it out, because this is a band I would never have heard of if it weren't for that box set. It's an amazing set, and this is one band I would never have known of, and I really like this song a lot, too. Glenn Matlock gets kicked out of the Sex Pistols for apparently talking too much about how Paul McCartney's great. And they're like, you know, Paul, fuck you, get out.
Yeah.
You know, and there's probably, I'm sure there's other things, too. That just sounds too much like a story you tell.
Yeah.
Anyways, he starts another band with a bunch of guys, including the later singer of Ultravox, Midgeur.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And the band is called Rich Kids. And they do a BBC session later that same year, and they made their one album. Mick Ronson produces it.
Oh, wow.
Late in 77. And the album's called Ghosts of Princes and Towers. It comes out in the late summer of 78. And like I said in the other podcast, I'm sure at some point the Pistols must have come to the same realization that I would have, which is that if you fire your main songwriter because he likes the Beatles too much,
yeah, you're done.
You find that you don't have anyone to write any songs with.
Which is what happened.
Exactly what happened. But this is the band he starts with, Midgeur as the singer after that. This is Rich Kids and from the album and the song of the same name, Ghosts of Princes and Towers. I really like that song. That's a great. It's funny to hear like that voice, Midgeur's voice in there. Like,
it is.
But I love that song. I would never have heard that if it wasn't for this Rhino set. I would never have found that song. It's just so. Anyways, we got to end for today. We've been going on for ages.
This is a great one, though. Great idea. I mean, I hope people are still hanging with us because it's 3 weeks of funk, and we're not done yet.
We've got one more, I would say.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, I'm being introduced to a lot of great music. I'm getting to put a spotlight on a lot of music that was very influential on me as a young man, a young musician, and young writer. And I know how much this stuff means to you. And it's a lot of fun doing this because it's one of the reasons why I connected with you, because we grew up in the same era and we can remember these things fondly. But also because looking back on it and finding new bands, like I'm totally in love with the Avengers now. I just listened to all Avengers songs for like a week. So this has been a lot of fun. It really has.
Yeah, I'm really digging it. I like the weeks where we just talk about stuff. I also like the weeks where we just play DJ for weeks on end, you know, like just like getting to play all these songs and like, well, there's no, you know, I lived in LA for a long time and I lived with a lot of people who are in the movie business at times. And, you know, I was just around a lot of others who are in the movie business and they're wonderful people, my friends, you know, but they do love to sit around. They will be very clear. They just want to talk about who sucks, who's terrible. And there's plenty of shit in the movie business that does suck and that is terrible. Whereas musicians just want to shove down your throat the latest great thing they heard. You know, and they want you to listen to it. They just want to, like, shove music down your throat. They're going to choke you on it.
This is our mixtape. This is our punk mixtape.
It's like we turn all of our friends into the foie gras of music. We just shove it down their throats until they choke.
Now, we should point out that there are some great enterprising people out there who have done a fantastic job creating Spotify playlists and iTunes playlists and other things based on As Heard on Underwater Sunshine. I think those people should just do the punk version. They shouldn't try to jam all these punk songs into the long list of songs playing on this. There should be a quintessential Underwater Sunshine, Adam Duritz, James Campion list of punk songs somewhere.
Well, we're providing them with a lot of it in this either way. whether anyone likes it or not, we are providing them with a great deal of them
like
in this
it
podcast. You know, next time we're going to finish this up.
We're going to finish the 70s, we promise.
We're into 1978 right now. It's a big year. We're going to come back with a lot of, like, Susie and the Banshees, the Undertones, the Only Ones, Stiff Little Fingers, the Members, the Pretenders, the Jim Carroll Band.
Ah, the Pretenders, yeah.
I think we're playing all this. Who knows? We might change our minds by next week. But I really hope you've enjoyed Underwater Sunshine this week. The punk rebellion continues from our living room in our 50s.
Thanks for listening. And we'll get you this medals will be coming out in the mail.
Y'all have a good week. Take care. This is Adam.
James, peace.
Signing off. Later.